Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Ira Harris and Peter Buchvar. Ira is a successful hedge fund manager and a global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003. And Peter is chief investment officer for the Bleakley Financial Group and Advisory. He has a newsletter product called the bookreport.com, BOOKREPORT.com, which has great macroeconomic insight and perspective with lots of updates on economic indicators. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hey, Richard, good to be here, guys.
Yep.
Great. I thought we'd begin with a reflection on the FOMC minutes today and the observation that you made recently, Ira, in your blog, that Peter Buchvar, Jim Bianco, and the former Bank of India Governor Raghuram Rajan have all raised concerns about the Fed raising rates while shrinking its balance sheet. This is leading to a rapid rise in borrowing costs for emerging market economies that have high levels of dollar-denominated debt. And so what is the consensus today from the FOMC minutes meeting perspective?
I'm sure Peter will speak more to the FOMC minutes. I've read through some of them. I'm sure he's much more ahead of me on this. But Peter and Jim and certainly Professor Rajan have discussed this and its impact, on the ripple effect. Every central bank, because the media is so enamored the fact that equity markets have risen and that and the central banks all raised that great concept of counterfactuals. Well, if we hadn't done this, well, they did do this, and I know that Peter and I and Richard, you have discussed this for years. They've overstayed this hand, and did they need QE 2 and 3? But the effects of the Bernanke Fed taking this to me a ridiculous end, which prompted the ECB and, of course, the Bank of Japan to take this to ridiculous ends, have sent global interest rates to very low levels, and I think has enabled, I think that's the right word, because when we enable an addiction to these ultra low interest rates, and it led to a huge amount of borrowing because of these low rates. And now that interest rates are moving up, but as Peter has pointed out, since he framed the QT or quantitative tightening, that now liquidity is being withdrawn, especially from the world's reserve currency, which has even greater effects than any other. And it's causing some dislocations because interest rates are going up and with it, liquidity is tightening. And that is, all these people who are borrowed up are now having to pay it back. Or if they're not paying it back yet, they will, their debt servicing costs are going to rise dramatically. So that's where we sit in the world. So I think it has great ramifications, but I'll leave my voice there and let Peter go on with it.
I agree with Ira's points. And the one ironic thing about monetary policy is that, and when you look back over 20 years, each successive cycle saw lower and lower interest rates because the debt buildup that has taken place over many years meant that we needed lower and lower interest rates, not only which encouraged the borrowing, but meant that higher rates than that would cause a major problem because of all this debt. So here the Fed says, okay, I'm going to cut rates to zero and I'm going to encourage you guys to go out and borrow and borrow and borrow. And now you've taken on a lot of debt and now it's time to raise interest rates. Well, they can't raise interest rates too much because all the debt that's been accumulated. So we're going to go into the next recession or downturn, whenever that might occur, with the Fed funds rate well below what it's been in the past. Likely Europe will go into the next recession with rates still negative, and Japan will probably do the same. So that's what's going to differentiate the next recession from previous ones, is the inability of central banks to be able to deal with it, because so many bullets have already been expended. So one of the problems there. So we'll leave it at that. But with respect to, you know, Ira mentioned the minutes. The minutes are, in a way, in addition to the FOMC statement, and that the minutes are not really minutes. When you think of minutes, it's okay, let's take notes about what's discussed. The Fed has turned the minutes into another messaging machine to be sort of an addendum to the minutes, the actual statement that comes out the day of a meeting. And typically nothing comes of it, and I don't really think anything came of it this time. But those that think, okay, the Fed's going to be talking about trade and worried about that they're going to be almost done, well, there are plenty of comments within the minutes that talked about companies having more leverage in raising prices. And there was also a great discussion on the yield curve, with some saying that, okay, we got to pay attention to the yield curve and we don't want to invert it. And then others said that that you can't infer economic causality from some statistical correlation, because there are global factors that are suppressing long-term interest rates, such as Ira said, very low rates in Europe and Japan. The question is which side of that argument is Jay Powell on? And I'm not sure of the answer.
Okay. And what about the effect of this on the U.S. equity markets? Ira, you've observed that there's a rallying in the U.S. markets relative to the rest of the world with a strengthening U.S. dollar. Could this be a trend, a change in trend from a prior correlation of weak currencies and you know, strong equity markets?
Well, you know, with the algorithmic world and the way that we respond to things, can it be a trend? I don't know how to define trend anymore. You know, it seems that 24 hours is a momentum trend, okay, and then it switches again. So in the big picture, I don't believe that those fundamentals have shifted dramatically. And I always find the currency arguments interesting, because they'll roll out. I love the different financial media outlets, because they'll roll out a CEO who, when the dollar is rallying, oh, it's affecting that's an outlier that's affecting our profitability, the strong dollar. But I've yet to hear a CEO in America who, when the dollar is weak and profits are growing, stand up and say, you know what, don't increase my bonus this year, because it really is due to extraordinary circumstances way beyond my control, and that the dollar was so weak you couldn't help but make money. So the argument about the dollar, it's, you know, right now you got both going together, and I guess it's because of, there's some fair, you know, the fact that the United States is a haven, so there's money flowing in. I still don't believe, you know, it's the same thing in China. A weak currency, you have a weak currency, but you have a real weak equity market. These are things that we haven't seen sustain themselves, and I don't believe they will sustain themselves as far as equity markets are correlative with currencies, long-held view will resurrect itself. But right now, you know what, we are in a situation where several correlations that we've seen have broken down. We also saw oil prices rally quite a bit with the dollar rally initially. So, you know what, that's the thing about correlations. They work until they don't work anymore. But certain long-held relationships, I think, will always reassert themselves. I almost sound like the Fed, given enough time, of course, we'll see that. So I must be working on a stochastic okay, equilibrium model.
Yeah. And your thoughts, Peter?
Yeah, no, I agree. Even look at the European stock markets this year with the recent weakness in the euro. It's done nothing to help European markets, particularly Germany, which is 40% dependent on exports. So, and to the point of algorithms, I stopped thinking that the equity market was a good discounting mechanism like it used to be. And I see it just responding to events and circumstances that's smack in the middle of its face. And like you take now, for example, and we see the weakness in overseas economies. Well, 40% of the S&P sources goods from overseas, but there's not one analyst saying that, okay, maybe revenue growth will be clipped here. And I think a lot of that does have to do with algorithms, because an algorithm, the input is the data that's already out there. It's not guessing what the data will be. So it's not saying, okay, well, China's growth is slowing, therefore 6 months from now it'll start to impact the U.S. and I should trim equities today. It's saying, okay, China's growth is slowing, but it hasn't affected the U.S. and the U.S. data is still good, therefore buy stocks. So I wouldn't look at the U.S. equity market as a discounting mechanism. And just look at 07. The credit markets were literally on fire in the beginning of 07. And the stock market hit an all-time record high in October 2007 because the Fed was cutting rates and they thought, oh, the Fed's here to save us, buy stocks when they cut rates. And on the flip side, we saw buy stocks in 2013, 14, 15, don't fight the Fed, don't fight the Fed. Well, now you don't hear anybody talking about, well, be careful of the Fed, be careful of the Fed. It's just buy stocks because things are good. So the narrative always changes and historical relationships are difficult to apply now because we've never had an experience of negative interest rates. You know, the German two-year is still minus 60 basis points. No historical precedent for that. So don't give me a seasonal analysis or an historical analysis about a yield curve when we're in a rate environment that's never been seen in the history of the world before.
Let me add, you know, because you're in Canada, Richard. Mm-hmm. So one of the – and I know Santelli talked about it today after him and I had a conversation. So one of the most interesting things is that the flattest yield curve, except out of outside Iceland, which – that's a different situation. But the Canadian curve is really flat, flatter than the U.S. I think it's 15 basis points this morning, which is interesting because they never had a QE program. So what is flattening the curve? Is it that the Canadians are now following the U.S. in raising rates and that the Canadian market is maybe a very effective barometer of that, hey, you know, you might be wrong here, that there are things and that you ought not to be raising rates in this fashion. But I find that very interesting what the Canadian curve is doing. And I'm starting to pay attention to it only because it's a purer view, although, of course, it is affected by, international capital flows, which are all affected by the major central banks. But I do find that curve being as flat as it is very interesting and something to watch here.
Yeah, it could be partly also because on concerns for trade, like with NAFTA, with the U.S. and concerns there on discussions on the treaty, revising the terms of the treaty, which could be negative to Canada, and also on real estate. There's been a lot of international capital flows into Canada recently, but there's been new measures in terms of taxation or tariffs, penalties imposed on foreign nationals or foreign entities outside of Canada on the real estate market. So it's no longer as it was before. So that a lot of jobs recently were created due to the real estate boom. So I think maybe those two concerns are bearing on Canada.
Oh, that's, I know it's worth discussing. So, everybody has ancillary reasons for why this, and it was interesting because Peter brought it up from the FOMC minutes about, the foreign flow of funds. So what are we back to a Bernanke argument about surplus savings? I guess there are still people at the Fed making that argument for the current state of affairs. That didn't sit well with me in 2006, and it sits less well with me right now because it fails to take into account the real impact and maybe the damage done by central bank policies. But that's a subjective opinion on my part.
Yeah, exactly. So we talked about the Fed. What about the Japanese central bank? So there's been some potential trends there in terms of the Japanese central bank buying less equities. They bought a lot of them in the past, and due to changes in the central bank policy, what are your thoughts on that? We can start with Ira.
No, I defer to Peter on that. I think he has a better sense of that. So, Richard, I'll defer to Peter.
So what's most interesting, well, when the Bank of Japan decided to go to yield curve control, it was their way of saying, we've already broken the Japanese bond market. We need to start buying less. Let's figure out another way of keeping rates really low. So they went from focusing on the price of money from the quantity of the money they printed. So they said, okay, let's keep the spread between the overnight rate and the 10-year rate close to zero, give or take 10 basis points. And that worked in the sense that it allowed them to dramatically cut QE, where they were running at the peak 80 trillion yen a month, and it got down to about 50 trillion yen. Problem was is that by destroying and flattening the yield curve to nothing, you damage the profitability of your banking system. And if your banking system is supposed to be the transmission mechanism for your policy, you actually end up tightening via the easing. Because if banks are no longer reluctant to, are reluctant to lend because there's no yield curve, well, then you're actually now tightening. They are now cutting back on, from what I'm hearing, the purchases of stocks. Well, when they become such dominant holders of so many different Japanese stocks, you actually scare Japanese equity investors because you know it is not sustainable unless the Japanese want to nationalize the Japanese stock market, but I don't think that's on their agenda. You actually scare potential buyers of Japanese stocks because you know you wonder and you fear what's going to happen when the Bank of Japan's done buying stocks, the market's going to fall. So their easing is now turned into tightening while they still ease. And I think that's why Kuroda shifted the yield curve control to 20 basis points, give or take, from 10. But even 20 basis points really isn't much from 10. So they have a major problem. The end game is somewhat over with the Bank of Japan. I just don't know how they're going to figure out a way to get out of it.
And along with that, go ahead, Ira.
Yeah, I would agree with, I think Peter has that absolutely right. And the Japanese, we don't really know what they, I think that's a really good point, is that their QQE, as they referred to it, of course, it was quality and quantity as they were buying stocks. We don't know. And I think they've been underbuying for a long time. That's why I wasn't so surprised when they made that announcement, and the initial reaction was, of course, a quick sell-off in the equity market and a quick rally in the Japanese yen. So, but I don't think it really was that great a surprise to the market because, again, they're not very transparent. It wasn't like, watching the ECB, who would publish, where they were at the end of every week, and you could kind of follow it, not that you knew exactly what they were buying according to the capital keys, but it was interesting. The Japanese have really been secretive here, and I think Kuroda has followed. I agree with Peter. I think this is a terrible policy, and I think he was able to do what he was doing because he could do it on the heels of, again, Ben Bernanke. I respect Jay Powell, and it's interesting to hear these views, but the United States does have a fiduciary. It's a global fiduciary. And when it fails in that, or it does things to create havoc in the system, and then everybody else follows it, going, well, they're doing it, and it's way, their system. Okay, I'm going to do this here. So we've gone to a preposterous measure of central bank activity in the world, and I think the first rumblings in the emerging markets is some of the coming price that's going to be paid. I can't tell you when. I wish I could, because then I could retire and then I could do these podcasts full time. I think it's really something to watch. And I think Peter's picking up on that with the Bank of Japan. I think they have got themselves into a terrible situation.
Yes. And Peter, what about the Japanese currency in the last couple of months? It seems to be increasing or strengthening at an even faster rate than the U.S. dollar.
Well, it's amazing. Yen is just like a conundrum. I mean, when you look at the Japanese monetary and fiscal situation, you'd say to yourself, why isn't it 250 versus the dollar, let alone, 110, 112? But I think the recent rally is strictly due to the change in Japanese policy in terms of yield curve control and continuing to trim QE. It was really just as simple as that. Where the yen goes from here is, you can flip a coin. As I said, on paper, it deserves to be a lot weaker. But, you know, considering how the U.S. has been handling, you know, its finances, who's to say that the dollar should be that much stronger against the yen? So I think what the end result is that printing a lot of money and weakening your currency is not necessarily the pathway to higher inflation. And that was the goal of the Bank of Japan, was to create 2% inflation, even though it was a completely unrealistic benchmark, particularly in a country that had a shrinking population and a growing, aging population that needs to save and really and spends less. Therefore, another reason why you're not going to get the higher inflation. So here we are with their balance sheet almost 100% of GDP, and they're the top 10 holder of 40% of Japanese equities listed on the Nikkei. And the CPI number, which comes out tonight, core CPI or core CPI, ex energy and food, is expected to be up all 0.3 year over year. It's astonishing.
Mm-hmm. And moving from Japan to China, Ira, you referenced a Financial Times news item in which it was stated that China's banking regulator has ordered to boost lending to infrastructure projects and exporters as the government seeks to bolster economic confidence on the eve of a new round of trade negotiations with the U.S. Your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts on that is that, you know, when I wrote that, that was a weekend article, which I thought was a very important article, and it did exactly what I thought it would do, which is we got, you know, the copper's been up all week and everything that was down, including, you know, everybody was bullish at the dollar. But, you know, this was done to assuage some of the immediate pressures. I don't think the Chinese have as much room as they would like to believe. But I thought it was a very interesting switch, because they're evidently a little bit nervous about too much slowdown too quickly in the Japanese economy. And I know Peter's been watching it. The Chinese bonds are also approaching very low levels. You know, they're almost as low as the U.S. 10-year. And that's in a country with, if we believe the numbers, you know, over 6% GDP growth. So they're getting a little bit worried, and they're worried about, you know, how far Trump's going to take this tariff issue. So I thought that was done in a way to politically assuage some in the White House, and hoping that they would be able to control more of the dialogue between the two and soften some of the rhetoric. So it was interesting. Another thing that took place, which today or yesterday, the German foreign minister. Well, let's hold off for that. Peter, you go with China, and then I will come back to the German foreign minister, because he did some interesting things.
Yeah, now China's in this tough spot where they acknowledge the success of credit growth that has led to so many imbalances in their economy, on top of massive leverage ratios. And that's why they've been pushing to try to at least bring lending onto bank balance sheets and off the shadow side. But at the same time, they don't want to suffer a big decline in GDP growth, and they still want that 6.5% type growth. Then you throw the tariffs in, which is a threat to growth, which causes another policy conundrum, because they want to slow credit growth, but then they want to speed it up to offset the impact of the tariffs. How this plays out is going to be a mystery, because China's economy overall is a mystery. I think over time, slowing credit growth and trying to, I don't want to say, maybe privatize is the wrong word, but continuing to shift their economy to more private sector dependent areas and businesses is a good thing. And I'm actually bullish on China long term. But how they manage this in the next year or two is going to be extraordinarily difficult, particularly if Europe is going to slow at the same time because of their own challenges and the end of QE, and Europe's a huge customer of theirs. And how they manage further relationships with the U.S. You know, now today, a delegation comes to the U.S. to discuss trade, and you know, I'm beginning to now wonder whether China is saying, you know what, we're not giving in, and we'll actually wait until after the election, the midterm election in the U.S., because if the Democrats take the House, well, Trump's going to have less leverage, and maybe we can not give in as much as he wants us to. So I think where the Chinese economy goes will be how much do they dig in. And I think they are, at least right now, showing some interest in digging in and not giving in to what Trump wants. Then you throw in this whole Michael Cohen thing, and while I think it's kind of irrelevant for the U.S. economy and markets, do they take that as a sign of vulnerability, which gets them to dig in even more? I don't. We'll have to see.
Back to the German foreign minister, Ira.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yesterday, the German foreign minister. Hold on one second. I have my. It's the only thing I was really interested in reading today. Heiko Maas. It was out. And I originally saw the story, and nobody really talked about it, but discussing that Europe and others need to break away from the stranglehold of the United States, especially the Office for Foreign Asset Control, which is under the U.S. Treasury, and its ability through sanctions and other mechanisms to control, of course, funds transfers globally, which is what the Russians and others, the Iranians, the Turks are all yelling about, because the U.S. Treasury really has the power to affect your ability to move money. And the German foreign minister came out and said, well, they have to get ready to move beyond this. I thought it was interesting that he came out with that following the Putin-Merkel meeting over the weekend. And then Merkel actually this morning came out in support. The article appeared in the Handelsblatt, and she came out and supported the foreign minister on those views. And it's really all directed at trying to circumvent the ability of the Swiss system, because it's priced in dollars, and the United States has a disproportionate amount of power to control a lot of global events because of it. So they want to circumvent it. I think that's what the Chinese would ultimately like to do. I think that's what the Russians would really like to get themselves out of, which is why they, you know, as I've talked about, they'd like to get these sanctions removed. It's a matter of what negotiating power Putin has with the Trump White House. And I'm not talking about the more sordid events, but I'm talking about the ability for the Russians to be able to influence, dramatically influence events in the Mideast. So this is all coming together at an interesting time. And I think that there's really a sense of pushback against the U.S. Bullying, as I think the world would say, in regards to foreign exchange flows. This is really nothing new. It really goes back to the 50s and 60s when the French were complaining about the same thing for different reasons, that the United States had way too much influence because of the dollar's role as a reserve currency. But I think this is important, and I think it needs to be on everybody's radar screen to pay attention to that.
Peter, any comments on that?
No, I mean, I agree with Ira. It's definitely something to watch. You know, all the goings on with emerging markets right now are important to watch. Mm-hmm. You know, it's no coincidence that just within a 6-month time frame that Turkey, Argentina, the Italian bond market, the short VIX trade have all of a sudden blown up. Well, you know, the liquidity flow is going the other way, and monetary tightening is taking hold, and you know, stuff begins to happen, accidents begin to happen, and things get more exposed. Investors become more discriminating; they become less tolerant of problems, and I expect more of these accidents as the months and quarters progress. The question is how insulated, or at what point the U.S. economy gets impacted by that?
Yeah,
and I think Richard, that the world has more concern now because they've seen a president or a political leader in the United States who is trying to change the entire narrative of the last 60 years anyway, and they're going, well, wow, we've really made ourselves subservient because of our needs for dollars. But when they see the ability to put this in, uses political leverage I think the world is very nervous about this now. So it is really gaining an ascendancy as an important piece of the discussion.
Yeah, and finally on that, relating to the emerging markets, if we look at countries with high risk for currency crises like Indonesia, Brazil, Argentina, Turkey, what do you make on Turkey, President Erdogan, and the possibility of capital controls? Ira?
Well, I think that's a great possibility. I know, you know, everybody, you hear all these what I call saccharine analysts who come out, oh, that's not going to happen because, you know, he's a rational actor and he's, why would you do that? I would be very careful with Erdogan. First of all, he's very good friends and very close to Mahathir Mohamad, who when he ran, now he's back as prime minister of Malaysia, but back in 1997, 98, during the Asian contagion, Malaysia did put on foreign exchange controls in September, I believe, of 1998, and it actually aided them. And they did it by thumbing their nose at the IMF. So where everybody else was running to the IMF and dealing with, well, we'll borrow money from you, but the IMF, of course, would only lend, especially at that time. Their playbook was, you know, raise interest rates and cut spending to rein in the deficits. So you were basically forcing yourself into a severe economic slowdown. Malaysia said no. And they went to foreign exchange controls where they tied up money for a longer period of time. And if you would do this now, I think, first of all, it would cause a lot of havoc in Europe because so many of the European banks are much more involved in Turkey than other banks because of the close ties. But I would be – foreign exchange controls are something that this market, the global market, really fears because anything that ties up – this whole market is built on the free flow of capital. So a country of Turkey's size with that much amount of debt, I think, would really cause negative reverberations throughout the system and set up a very potential negative feedback loop as far as global liquidity. And I think that could really cause problems. It's something that you have to watch here. And Erdogan is a, you know, he's first and foremost cares about Erdogan. So I think we should be very attentive to this.
And Peter.
Yeah, no, I agree with Ira, because you can imagine being an emerging market investor in Turkey and all of a sudden you can't get your money out. Well, you're going to sell everything else you can to offset that. So the capital flight from other emerging markets could be rather extreme. Now, Turkish government has said that they're not going to go there, but just wait, because they say that today doesn't mean they're going to change their mind tomorrow, as Ira mentioned, the precedent that we saw in Malaysia 20 years ago. So it would definitely cause a lot of problems. And we have to, this is all related to excessive leverage, a lot of it at the corporate level, a lot of it denominated in dollars, which is not the currency that they collect revenue in. And a classic repeat of the search for yield. And okay, give me zero interest rates. Well, then get me yield. And if I can lend money to Turkey for 8%, I'll take it. Classic search for yield that is now causing a rethink. And as I said earlier, a more discriminating view on the part of investors when interest rates rise, monetary tightening picks up. It's like we keep repeating the same movie over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Just has some, just, you know, some different colors and some different acts, but it's the same underlying theme over and over and over again in the history of financial markets.
Yes, exactly. And we'll end it there. Great insight, as always, gentlemen. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Ira?
I blog at Notes from Underground, all the podcasts that I've done with Peter and Financial Repression Authority. This is a good way to get the discussion out there, and I'm glad we have the opportunity to do this because I think investors need to hear these things. That, you know, you can't just put on rose-colored glasses and, well, you know, earnings are forever and we're going up, and no, it just doesn't work that way. As Peter just reminded us, that, you know, things are changing and that you have to be attentive to them. And whether you agree or disagree, you have to put it into your quiver and at least have the knowledge of it because when these things happen, and it's not that they're not going to happen. It's just, of course, as everything else in life, it's all about timing and understanding it. So I just push the idea of understanding it, and that's what you'll find in my blog, Notes from Underground.
Yes, exactly. And Peter?
So you can read my daily work at bookreport.com, BOOCKreport.com. And if you're interested in asset management or other financial planning, you can check us out at bleakly.com.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Peter, good to talk with you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.